Welcome to the intimacy, trust, and vulnerability. Why are these so hard? Workshop of World Convention of NA 34. My name is Mark, and I am an addict. Hi, everyone. They asked me to read this announcement first, so here we go. Badges. Please note that members must wear their badges to enter the convention center beyond the registration area. And please, please, be careful that your badge does not fall from its clip. Some members have tied theirs to their lanyard to ensure they are not lost. Okay, lunch. Remember that we have concessions throughout the convention center so that you can have lunch without needing to leave the convention. Beginning at 11 a.m., you can find food sales in Tides in the lobby area and in the food court on the terrace outside of Ballroom 20, upper level. Smoking around the exits. We have identified the entrance in front of Hall A and Hall F as non-smoking entrances. Smokers, please do not use the sidewalk area outside of Hall A and outside Hall F to smoke. These are designated non-smoking areas. Entertainment. We still have jazz, brunch, and concert tickets available. You can purchase them in the registration area. The Friday Night Festival starts at 9:45 tonight in the Sales Pavilion. We have a great lineup of musicians, including Trombone, Shorty, and Ozo Motley. This is going to be a great show. You won't want to miss it. Tonight's dance starts at 10 p.m. in the Grand Hyatt, Manchester Ballroom. Photos, videos, and social media. We recognize that it is a common practice for members to take photo and videos at NA events and to post them on social networks. We do not believe this to be in conflict with our traditions, so long as they are for the enjoyment of members and are not made available to the general public. Please be considerate of our guiding principles and the anonymity of others as you share your photos and videos from World Convention of NA 34. Thank you. All right. Can we open this portion of the meeting with a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you. All right. I have asked Todd from Colorado to read Who is an Addict?
I'm Todd. I'm an addict. Who is an addict? Most of us do not have to think twice about this question. We know. Our whole life and thinking was centered in drugs in one form or another, the getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. We live to use and use to live. Very simply, an addict is a man or woman whose life is controlled by drugs. We are people in the grip of a continuing and progressive illness whose ends are always the same: jails, institutions, and death.
Thanks, Todd. All right, I've asked Jenny from San Diego to read Who is an Addict? And she is excited to be here reading this.
Good afternoon. My name is Jenny, and I'm an addict from San Diego. From San Diego. Why are we here? Before coming to the fellowship of NA, we could not manage, I'm sorry?
You're supposed to be reading Who's an Addict.
Oh, well, I didn't get that one.
Pardon?
What, Trey?
Oh, I'm sorry. No.
Just keep
my
going?
Mistake, yeah.
Okay, here we go. My name's Jenny, I'm an addict. So, okay. Why are we here? Before coming to the fellowship of NA, we could not manage our own lives. We could not live and enjoy life as other people do. We had to have something different, and we thought we had found it in drugs. We placed their use ahead of the welfare of our families, our wives, husbands, and our children. We had to have drugs at all costs. We did many people great harm, but most of all, we harmed ourselves. Through our inability to accept personal responsibilities, we were actually creating our own problems. We seemed to be incapable of facing life on life's terms. Most of us realized that in our addiction, we were slowly committing suicide. But addiction is such a cunning enemy of life that we had lost the power to do anything about it. Many of us ended up in jail, sought help through medicine, religion, and psychiatry. None of these methods was sufficient for us. Our disease always resurfaced or continued to progress until in desperation we sought help from each other in Narcotics Anonymous. After coming to NA, we realized we were sick people. Very. We suffered from a disease from which there is no known cure. It can, however, be arrested at some point in recovery, and recovery is then possible.
Yeah. Wow.
Whoops. Okay. Khadija has been asked to read a portion of our literature.
Hi, everyone. My name is Khadija, and I'm an addict in recovery from Los Angeles.
Hi.
May 24th, risking vulnerability. As we grow, we learn to overcome the tendency to run and hide from ourselves and our feelings. Basic text, page 81. Rather than risk vulnerability, many of us have developed habits to keep others at a safe distance. These patterns of emotional isolation can give us the feelings we are hopelessly locked behind our mask. We used to take risks with our lives. Now we can take risks with our feelings. Through sharing with other addicts, we learn that we are not unique. We do not make ourselves unduly vulnerable simply by letting others know who we are, for we are in good company. And by working the 12 steps of the NA program, we grow and change. We no longer want or need to hide our emerging selves. We are offered the opportunity to shed the emotional camouflage we developed to survive our active addiction. By opening ourselves to others, we risk becoming vulnerable. But that risk is well worth the rewards. With the help of our sponsor and other recovering addicts, we learn how to express our feelings honestly and openly. In turn, we become nourished and encouraged by the unconditional love of our companions. As we practice spiritual principles, we find strength, freedom, both in ourselves and in those around us. We are set free to be ourselves and enjoy the company of our fellow addicts. Just for today, I will openly and honestly share with other recovering addicts. I will risk becoming vulnerable and celebrate myself and my friendship with other NA members. I will grow.
Thank you, Khadija. All right. Without further ado, I would like to introduce our first speaker, Mona Lisa from Nashville.
Hi, family. I'm Mona Lisa. I'm an addict. And, you know, I have freaked out about it and been nervous about it, and I'm just letting it go now, you know. We were discussing who should go first. I said, please let me go first so I can exhale. You know, he's done. Please, let me just get it over with. Let me take another moment of silence. Thank you. Again, family, I'm Mona Lisa. I'm an addict living in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm originally, yeah, yay, Nashville. But I also need to say I'm originally from St. Louis. Yeah. Because I got two groups of families here, so I always have to say I'm represented by both groups. I just couldn't seem to stay clean at home, you know. I just was not able to stay clean in St. Louis, so I fled to Nashville. And that's really what it was, almost run out of town, actually, almost. But I thank God that was 14 years ago. My clean date is February 19th, 1997. And, you know, I don't say that, I say that to be grateful, to say how far I've come. It took me a long, long time to stay clean. You know, I could always quit, but I just couldn't stay clean. It took a long time. Lots of treatment centers, psych wards, everything. You know, so when I say 14 years, I mean I am so grateful, so very grateful to be here. And I want to thank the world for asking me to do this workshop. When I looked at the topic, I thought, okay, intimacy, trust, and vulnerability, why are these so hard? You know, where do I start with that one? Growing up, we were, I'm the oldest of four. Our parents were very young when we were born. My mom was, and they're both the same age. They were 17 when I was born and 21 when my brother was born, the fourth child. So this was in the 50s, so you know, they didn't believe in birth control at that time, apparently. So it was four babies in 5 years. So, as a result of that, I kind of feel like we grew up with our parents a lot. So they did talk to us a lot. You know, we did have a lot of trust and a lot of intimacy. You know, we had a lot of other dysfunction going on too now. You know, like everybody else, we had our share of stuff. But I didn't know what trust was. I knew what healthy relationships were. But, you know, of course, all that changed when you started using. You know, you just become this totally different being, you know, not even a human at that point, you know, just something totally, totally different. So, and I used for about 13 years, 13 straight years, 13 hard years. When I commented about not being able to stay clean in St. Louis, you know, growing up, I was kind of the bookworm, you know. I was the first person in my family to attend and graduate from college. I did all this before using, you know, I wasn't using drugs. Well, I wasn't abusing drugs. Let me clarify that. You know, let me clarify that. So I was using, I was not abusing them at that point. You know, at that point, I could do like other people do, you know, have a glass of wine and a joint and then go home and go to work the next day. Well, when I got introduced to crack, all of that changed, you know. All of it changed. I mean, I was kind of sheltered in a way, but I knew what was going on, and I was one of those people that my parents were kind of strict on that, so I was kind of sheltered, but it was something, I don't know, it was something about that fast life that I liked, you know. I wanted to go to school, go to college during the day, and then hook up with the hustlers afterwards. You know, I just liked that. Even when I graduated, you know, I worked for the court. I was a juvenile officer. And the guy I was dating was at the cab stand in the corner gambling while I'm in my business suit in court all day. You know, really, really weird. You know, at that time, you're so young and naive, you know, and you think that you can lay in the dirt and don't get dirty, basically. You know, I thought that I could dibble and dabble in some things and not be affected by it. That's not what happens around here. You know, you keep going to the barbershop to get a haircut sooner or later. So I was introduced to crack at a really late age. I didn't start using until I was in my 30s, actually. So that's kind of late for me. That was pretty late, I thought. But I didn't take any time to just go all the way down. At this time, I had a home. I had an excellent career. I was a fundraiser for the American Red Cross. I had some shit going on, you know. But, of course, I lost it all. You know, well, you know, if you stay up getting high all night, you can't go to work the next day. I couldn't go to work the next day. I don't know what y'all did, but I could not be geeking and go to work. They just didn't match. I couldn't do that. I could not leave my house, and I got high, you know. And I was making the kind of money where I could get high a lot, you know. And not only that, you know, I was a lot younger, sexy, hot, and all that shit. So, you know, men were just giving it to me. I never had to leave, you know, which was so unhealthy. So unhealthy. They were killing me, you know, just bringing shit to me, you know. One would be leaving out the back door, one coming in the front door. It was just insane. You know, it really was. Of course, I didn't think it was insane at the time. It was hip then to me, you know, really hip. Really pretty sad. Of course, it doesn't take long to, you know, the rest of the story is that you lose your job and then you lose another job. And then I just said, screw it. I just quit looking. You know, I mean, it was more important to get high than use, you know, than to work. During this time, and I know we're supposed to have like 30 minutes, so I'm going to kind of condense my story part of it. During this time of total insanity, my mom took my daughter to live with her. Because you can't run the streets all night and take care of a kid, especially when they wake up and find themselves home alone, you know, and call my mom. And, of course, that was calling the damn infantry, you know. My mom was no joke. She's sitting there with her gun and shit waiting on me when I come home, threatening me. You know, but, you're so strung out by then, it doesn't even matter. You know, it just didn't even matter, you know. Anyway, my daughter ended up living with my mom for quite a while, actually until she left for college. Instead of that being painful enough to stop, of course, you know, it just made me use more. So, you know, so that was that 13-year run. And I went to four treatment centers. And finally, in Nashville, I have a sister who had moved there with General Motors at that time and suggested I come and live with her. And I thought, Nashville? What the hell is in Nashville, Tennessee? You know, this city slickster here. You know, and she reminded me of how bad I was doing at this point. You know, I was barely holding on to my home at this point. You know, at this point, you know, you look like a straight shooter. Not only are you doing bad, you're looking bad, too. So I thought, what the hell, you know. Because I just could not say no. Every time somebody called, you know, I got a pack. I just couldn't say no, you know. I just couldn't do it. So I thought, well, if I just leave St. Louis, you know, it'll be different. Of course, then I found the drugs in Tennessee. So, anyway, that was that last run. Thank God that was the last run in 97. And I finally went to treatment the fourth time for me. Not because my mom had threatened me, which she had numerous times. But I finally went for me and got clean and stayed clean. So, but it's at this point, when I think about this topic, you're talking about all these things that we talk about in our literature about spiritual principles and trust and intimacy. That was not how I survived on the streets. You know, trying to manipulate, you know, somebody paying the mortgage, somebody paying the utilities, somebody getting the food, somebody taking care of the clothes. That did not take trust and intimacy. So these are things I had to kind of relearn when I got here. And because I was so beaten down and so beaten up, I was willing, you know. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but at least I was willing. You know, I really felt like I was at the end of the road. What was there else to do? I mean, truly nothing. You know, I had lost everything and was on the verge of losing my child at that point. Because she had said that if you can't stay clean, Mama, you know, I don't even want to be a part of your life. You know, and that's why I went to treatment that last time. But I stayed for me. And that was the best thing for me. Now, when I got here, I thought that was just easy. You know, I said, God, when I could at least get 30 days without using dope, okay, I might be able to do this. Then y'all want me to do some damn work around here. So about steps and developing relationships and a sponsor and confiding in people. You know, my very first sponsor said, you know, and I told her what my concerns were. I said, you know, I'm just kind of, you know, I didn't confide in a lot of people in the dope house, you know. Just the opposite, you know. How do you confide with other women and not feel ashamed and embarrassed and like dirt, you know. That's what I felt when I got here. So my sponsor taught me how to feel better. You know, they talk about being vulnerable. To say these kinds of things to staff here in a meeting. And I love you. I love you, Danita. Danita was the first woman to really share in a meeting, honestly. And that's what gave me the courage to continue doing that. That's why I will always love you. I love all of the women that are in my life, but it meant so much to not feel like the Lone Ranger. Like I wasn't the worst slut in the world. I wasn't the only woman in the world who'd done the things that we do around here, but are able to rebuild a life. So learning how to live by spiritual principles became very important to me again. I wanted to be that lady that I once was when I was with the American Red Cross. I want to be that lady that my family thought so much of, being the first child, the first person to graduate from college, that had so many things going, you know, before it just all went down the toilet. And in order to do those things, these are the kinds of things that you have to practice. You know, trust, God, opening up. I mean, and one of the things it says, why are these so hard? Because you have to just get buck naked. That's what you feel like when I'm up here. You know, like I don't have a stitch of clothes on. You know, to tell you honestly how I'm feeling and what I did, you know, to get here. And to stay here, more importantly, to stay here. Developing relationships with other women, with a sponsor, with a support system. Learning how to develop healthy relationships with men. You know, what can you do for me, and this is what I can do for you kind of thing. You know, to do something different. You know, to be able to have healthy platonic relationships again. You know, it felt so good. It felt so good to be in a place. And what I learned early on was that you have to do this kind of work in order to get these kinds of results. And I learned that early on, and I think that was one of the benefits of starting this process so late, is that I had some other life experiences. And I know for a fact you get out of things what you put in them, without a doubt. You know, so I put that same kind of tenacity into staying clean and trying to live by these principles as best I can. You know, and we've all fall short sometimes. But what I try to do on a regular basis is remain as humble, as honest as I possibly can, and try to do the best that I can. You know, to learn how to share with sponsees things that you've experienced, because it was important that what I learned here is that sometimes people look at the outside and see one thing. But that's not necessarily how that person is. So you need to know that what you see isn't what you got. You know, it's you need to know that. And so I needed to be real honest with people and to say that what I look like now is not what I felt like 14 years ago. It was not. And for a while, until we do some work around here, until we get honest with ourselves, until we, you know, share how it feels when you in a relationship and it breaks up. And let me tell you how many damn relationships I've been in and broke up in recovery. You know, let me just say, there is not a ring finger on this hand yet. So what that means is that we survive breakups clean. It was also very important to me that not only do I survive them, that I don't go sleeping around. That was the other part of that for me. Just because you do something, I'm going to go screw your friend or whatever. You know, I didn't want to be sitting in a room and slept with him and him and him and him. That's not my MO. And that's just not what I wanted to do. So, you know, so what that means is, though, sometimes you get lonesome a lot of times, but but you know what I got back? Feeling good about me. That's what I got back, though. That was the flip side of it, you know. So I try to be very honest with the women in my life and seeing how we can survive this and how we survive just everyday living. Shit happens. You know, but you can't fall apart. You wouldn't make it if you fell apart every time something happens or a relationship happens. And I'm a true testimony that you do survive multiple relationships, you know, without becoming a slut, without using, and without other negative behavior. You know, once I got clean and stayed clean, I really started liking that feeling. I did not want to lose that, no matter what. No matter what. So there were times when you see me looking like this. I'm feeling like crap inside now. But, you know, it's you keep coming back. And I started to keep sharing about it and sharing about it. You know, I would share with my sponsor, share with a couple of women. And then I got more vulnerable and start sharing in meetings and letting people see that, you know, sometimes I'm hurting. I'm hurting like hell sometimes. But you do survive. You know, you do survive. Being vulnerable. You know, I talked about my daughter living with my mom. My daughter probably stayed with my mom from 10, 11, till she left for college. So my mom passed away the year I moved to Nashville. So, and that had been my rock. And all those other men that was taking care of the mortgage and utilities and all that shit, they were so tired of my ass by then, you know. They were by the wayside, too, you know. When I got clean, I knew I needed to reestablish that relationship with my child because it was only she and I. I only have one child. And her father had been killed several years ago. So I was all she had and she was all I had. Now, you're talking about being vulnerable. And acknowledging and taking responsibility for what I had put her through. That was some deep shit. That was some hard shit. But we got through it. It's been very, very difficult. We've done therapy. Thank God for therapy. You know, I do, you know. Thank God for that. Let me say that I know the place that NA is first in my life. Now, first and foremost. But I'm not ashamed to say there's sometimes when you have to go beyond that and do some other things. And that's what we did. You know, we did that. We still do it sometimes. It meant so much to her. And I had no idea how much it meant to her when I started putting that kind of effort into salvaging our relationship. When she graduated from college, and she graduated magna cum laude from Spelman. On a presidential scholarship, too, on top of that. Have a great kid. She's a financial advisor on Wall Street. So, I am so proud of her. What I also did was I had to do a lot of work on me to also say I did have a part in that, in some of that. It wasn't all bad. I wasn't all bad all the time. You know, there was some good things, you know. And so I took those things and just continued to build on those things. As a result of that, we've got the best relationship now through a whole lot of work. Last year, let me back up a little bit. I had done an amends to her when I did my ninth step several years ago. And when I did that first amends, I don't know how everybody else feels, but I just wanted to, it was kind of like this. I wanted to get it over with, you know. I wanted to do it and be over with. And say, that's done. But I remember when I did it, she didn't really have a response. But I didn't really say anything. You know, you all say that I'm not supposed to worry about the results. So I didn't worry about the results. You know, I just kind of said, okay. As she got better along in her process, she finally came to me and just said that your amends wasn't sufficient. Yeah, that was some deep shit. That was last year. Last year, I was going through some severe medical issues, and we didn't know what was going on. The doctors didn't know what was going on. First, they thought it was pancreatic cancer. I mean, it was a rough year for me last year. But so in the midst of all this, she kind of flared up with this, and I'm going, what the hell? I mean, you know, I've been clean 13 years at this point. What the hell? That's all I can say. So I called my sponsor, and of course, was talking to her about it. And my sponsor said, you know, along our recovery journey, we have deeper levels of everything that we experience. You don't do one surrender. You're not powerless one time. Everything we go through, you're going to keep going through a deeper level of it. She said, this is another deeper level that you're going to have to go through with her. And so, you know, my first inclination was to say, how fucking dare her? That was my first response. How fucking dare her? And then I had to get out of me and say, how does she feel? I don't know what it feels like to have a mother who used drugs. I don't know how I would react. What she's going through is her process, and I have to allow her process. So I prayed about it and talked to my sponsor and, you know, my little inner circle, my support. And it came to me. I said, you know, they tell us that this is a program of practice. You have to continue to do things. So that means to me, what I got out of that is that it sounded like I needed to do another amends. You know, because my first amends was about that long. So I just said, you know what? Let me look at this from her point of view. Let me try to put myself in her shoes and see how she must feel. I took a weekend, and when I got through writing, I think I had like four pages front and back. It was just, you know, and I said, I felt such a peace when I'd done it. And I went over it with her. And she said, Mama, that's all I wanted you to do. I just wanted you to acknowledge how I felt. So I've said I'm sorry like 10,000 damn times. That wasn't what she wanted. And that wasn't, I need to do a deeper level of an amends. That's what it was. It was a deeper amends. From that day, I mean, it was such a change in her. That was what she needed, you know? And I can't say it wasn't what she needed. It was what we needed. It was what we needed. I'm telling you, from that day forward, it has been, you know, we have this thing where we call it fighting fair. You know, it used to be, you know, early on, you know, she'd get pissed off about something, not speak to me for 2 weeks, and, you know, I'd say, fuck it, you know, okay, shit, you know. I'm the mama, you're going to need me before I need your ass, so. You know. But that wasn't real healthy either, so I need to say that. And thank God we stay in this process and learn that, okay, that's not the healthiest response. Let me keep doing the best that I can do. And that was the key for me. Am I doing the best that I'm doing? Not just enough to get by, not just, well, how dare her say that? You know, put myself in her place. It has been the biggest change. She recently took a leave of absence from Wall Street. She's actually staying with me in Nashville for a few months. She has written a book on financial planning, and it's being published. So she wanted to kind of decide where she's going next and stuff, and saved up her money. And you know, when you got it like that, you can do that. She's done the footwork to do those things. But the difference that it has made in our relationship is just phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. You know, we no longer, if we're having a disagreement, you know, we don't get mad, we don't not speak. You know, we call it fighting fair now. You know, sometimes you just have to agree to disagree, you know. But it's just so different. It's just so different. The difference, I know, was because of me, what I started doing differently. You know, I just started making sure that I was digging as deep as I could and being the best. Now, mind you, I am not one that's going to pay penance for the rest of my damn life for using. You know, I'm just not going to do that now. You know, I'm going to try to be the best woman that I can. But I'm not going to be sorry fucking forever. I'm just not. I'm just not. You know? But what I am going to do is just do the best that I can. So I wanted to wrap up with something. It just kind of stuck out for me about this topic. And this is from the sixth edition of the basic text. It was from a story, Life on Life Terms. It says, trust the process. I shared my intimate secrets with NA and did not get rejected. So I started to open up even more. Through these relationships, I am learning intimacy in my other relationships. With my colleagues, with other family members, I have learned to trust, make myself vulnerable, and ask for help, especially in things I have had no experience with. Not only has NA changed me, it has made me more comfortable with that change. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Thank you, Mona Lisa. And now I would like to introduce our second speaker, Mark S. from Sydney, Australia.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mark, and I'm an addict. And I'm from Sydney, Australia, and very glad to be here. There's at least half a dozen people in the house that will understand my accent, thank God. This room looked like a pack of sardines when the meeting first started, and I thought, they can't get any more people in here, surely. I'd just like to talk a little bit about how I got here and I was unable to stay clean. And over a 2 to 3 year period, I had over 20 admissions into treatment centres. And in Australia at that time, they didn't have the 30-day chips. Not that it mattered to me, because I never got 30 days up to get one. And I suppose I most probably would have had the welcome tags, you know, that I would have had so many of those. But I say that I had 20 admissions to a treatment centre because there are people that honestly believe they're unable to stay clean. And I went to a treatment centre that no one had ever got clean from. I'm sorry. I went to a rehabilitation centre that no one had ever got clean from. It had only been open 25 years, so give it a chance. 12 of my admissions were into that same rehab. But no longer can they say that no one ever got clean from there. I wasn't the first one to get clean from there, and I'm sure I won't be the last. And I have a whole peer of friends that got clean from there. And we can laugh and joke about the times that we had there. And what happened from there was that I don't know what happened. I don't know why it happened. And I have no idea when I look back at it that I was able to stay clean. And I was able to get a sponsor. And that was hard. We do things a lot different in Australia. We're not big huggers when we greet. I'd rather shake your hand and keep you at a distance. So intimacy isn't one of our greatest assets. But one thing I did notice the other night, that whether I like it or not, or whether you like it or not, there is an intimacy in here. We're having dinner, and there must have been 50 or 60 people in that restaurant with these on, and it was fun, you know. It was like being in a family of 60 people, and the waitress wasn't the nicest waitress in the world, and. You know, the half a dozen people, normal people, came in and sat down. And she brought the menu out to them, and by the time she'd brought the napkins and the knives and forks out, they all got up and left. And she said, "Feel free to come back on my day off." And then she spoke to some of the other people that were ordering from the fellowship, and they wanted their mayonnaise or their sauces on the side. And she said, "You guys are high maintenance." And all I could say was, "You should have seen us before we got here." And the crazy thing about it, as you walk into the restaurant, there's a chalk mark on the ground of a body that had been laying there. And I thought, that would have been you. And it's hard to have, you know, I love a laugh. It's very important that I laugh. If I came here and I didn't laugh for the weekend, I'm wasting my time. You know, And the interesting part of that, of this for me, is that I've met people I haven't seen for 6 years here, that I was lucky enough to go to the World Convention in Hawaii, and some of the people I haven't seen since then. And it's like we just started on the last sentence that we left her with. And we're back to... And we're talking again. And it was like we'd never left. And that's important, you know? And the trust part of it. Look, they talk about why are they so hard. I'm the most untrustworthy person in the world. You know? I went and got merchandise yesterday. I went through the jewellery section and they had the bumper stickers and stuff like that. And the one that I went for was the... And it had... I may not be much at all, but I'm the only thing I ever think of. similar reading to that. And I thought, I got a half a dozen friends I could buy one of these for. And in actual fact, I could put the six on my own car. I woke up this morning about 3 o'clock and my head was here. And I shared, and you should have been there, it was a great one. And I thought, you know, when I woke up, I'd forgotten all about what I'd actually dreamt, you know, or half asleep and thinking about anxiety to be here at a world convention, to be asked to share. And you wouldn't have asked advice from me before I got here. It would have only meant a trip to prison. You know, it would have meant devastation to listen to anything that I had to say. And, so these things are hard to me, you know, to be that truthful person. I'm the person that you can see with his hand in the cookie jar. And I rip it out before you get there and say, no, you, I wasn't doing that. And the worst scenario is that you'd actually grab my hand in the cookie jar, and as I pulled it out, I'd be telling you that wasn't my hand. So that was the makeup I had. And I honestly realised that that stuff was no good. You know, I had to change a whole lot of things in my life, and it was very important that I did. You know, today, I think the most important part about my life today is that I not only try to be the best person I can here, but I have to practice that out there. And I joined this group of people. And it's a very fast-growing thing for men that are retired mainly. And they've made me the welfare officer. Like, and that's no big deal, but, like, they want me to take care of the welfare of other people. And that's a strange place for me to be. I have no, little idea of doing that sort of stuff, but I live and I learn, and I suppose that's the most important thing. You know, I spoke about these things of treatment centres and admissions into these treatment centres so many times, and I didn't like this place. I didn't like you people. I didn't like this program. And my first meeting, I was in a... I don't know if you have them here, but we have government pyjamas where the tops don't match the bottoms, and there's very few times there's a drawstring in the pants. And that was my first introduction. And Talk about feeling vulnerable. You know, talk about feeling less than. Certainly not equal to. And, you know, so I came in here and I didn't like what I saw. I didn't trust anyone that I saw. And I really didn't have any time for any of you. But don't take that the wrong way. I disliked you equally. I had no favourites, but that's the way it was. And I suppose over a period of time, it's changed a lot. My first sponsor was an American, and he's passed away now. And I'd let him know of my ideas, and he was a wonderful man. He didn't never judge me, but he smiled a lot when I told him these ideas. And I knew by the smile that what I was saying wasn't really good. And he helped me a lot. He put me in a direction where I had no idea of what was going to happen. It was all new and strange. And I didn't know what territory I was heading into. But my last shot was on the 31st of March behind a bush where people were walking past, and I could see them, and I actually believed that they couldn't see me. You should have been there. Thank God that was my last day using. And my clean date is April Fool's Day, 1985. And I honestly believe that I wouldn't have got there unless I was persistent. That I was willing to try it one more time. And what made me try it one more time was that I came into this fellowship, I seen people that were staying clean, and I'd go out and use. And before that needle was out of my arm, I was thinking about the people in here. And that's a lousy place to be. I don't know if anyone else in this room has experienced that, but it's a terrible place to be. Trying to get laid and think about people that are clean. And, yeah. But, you know, I look back over the journey that I've travelled, and I've been lucky to be able to, this is my third World Convention, and, I don't seem to be able to save any more than been able to get out once every 6 years. And I should try harder now as I'm getting older. But, you know, this fellowship has done so much, you know. And like that feeling of being in a restaurant of 60 people, all with a common bond. They speak about it in the basic text. And, you know, it's important to me to have people around that are heading in the direction that I am. And I love this to be a safe place to come. That's very important for me. My children are grown up now. And, you know, up until this point in time, they haven't needed to come in here. But from the very beginning, when I first got clean, my youngest children were 1 and 2, and the eldest ones were 15 and 13. And they were experimenting with alcohol. And the best information I could give to them was that I'll keep a seat for you. And up until today, they haven't needed that. But now I've got grandchildren, and I want you to keep it a safe place for them if they ever need to be here. And that stuff comes around, you know. I remember my 25th birthday, and someone got up and said, "Yeah, you've been clean longer than I've been alive." My response was, "I didn't think I was going to live this long." I honestly didn't think I was going to live this long. You know, I didn't want to live this long. But one day, clean, you're not worried about how long you're going to live. Because I just wanted to die. And day two wasn't much better. And as it got along, I still wasn't sleeping. I didn't think that it was ever going to get any better. But one day it did, you know. And not only that, a friendship has eventuated from this. I have friends from overseas, like I spoke about, that I can look at and see once every 6 years, and then turn around and be actually able to start that conversation once more, you know. And one of those friends from Hawaii, we saw in the merchandise line, and he's given us merchandise from a convention in Hawaii before we even get to buying the stuff that we were looking for, you know, waiting in the line. I don't know if anyone else got in that line, but it just went on and on and on. Yeah. It took an hour and a half to get in there. Yeah. And I'm worried about, oh, they're going to have my size T-shirt there. Yeah. It's all about me. I got the bumper sticker. And it is, you know. But I like to give back. And I have friends in this fellowship that I look at these people and I don't understand why that I love them. I admire them. And I like what they got. And, you know, and I've had the pleasure too of also meeting a lot of people that have come in, and their personal growth has been astronomical. And I look at them and I go, "Wow, you should have seen them when they first came in. Look at them now." Because that's where I see growth. I don't see growth in myself because my disease has never had a nice thing to say about me. My disease is still the vulture at the head of the bed. And he's glad that I'm awake. He loves to talk to me. He'll talk to me any time of day. No matter where I am, no matter what I'm doing. You know, he can talk to me when I'm speaking to my sponsor. And that's the way it is. And I look back at that stuff and I remember my first sponsor. And I was disease-ridden. No wonder I didn't make sense. But the most important thing about it was he smiled. And that stuff, I was able to realise that, you know, what I'm saying don't mean much. It's not real good. It's not healthy. And I never had a healthy day of living in my life before I got here. You know, I didn't start drinking till I was 13. And in Australia, you can drink when you're 18. And by the time I was 16, I was going to the pub with my parents. And, you know, there was no big deal about that at that point in time. But I wanted to drink before I was that, you know, before I was that old. I remember the boy walking to school, unable to hold his head up. I don't like what I am. I don't appreciate what I am. And I held very little regard for myself. And the journey I travelled was based upon that. And it's come up with that stuff, you know, they talk about, well, this meeting is about the trust and the intimacy and the vulnerability. All of those things were all of the things that I never practiced in my life. Unable to do so. But a lot of things have changed in my life. I got a wonderful friend in the fellowship over there, and his sponsor said to him, he'll go a long way in this fellowship because you've got a long way to go. And that's me. You know? And the good part about that is, no matter how far I've got to go, while ever I'm looking at that part of being teachable, I'm able to go in that direction. The day that I think I know everything will be the biggest mistake of my life. And I love what I got. And, you know, I got some wonderful people in my life. And that trust and intimacy are part of it. And I'm not real good at it. I'm not real good at the intimacy part of it. You know? And, but I'm getting better. Slowly but surely. And while ever I stay here and stay clean a day at a time, I know things are going to get better. They can't get any worse. I've seen the worst. And that doesn't mean a lot of things in life don't come up and bite you on the ass. Because they do. And I was in a meeting there and a friend passed away. And I had a wonderful friend who passed away not long ago. And we used to go to his place every Saturday. And we went there every day, every Saturday for 4 years. Because he was unable to get to meetings. And that's where personal growth and intimacy became part of my life. I was better at that when he was alive. And these are the things I need to practice now that he's gone. And he died in recovery. He rang me up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And he said, I've taken the biggest half of the tablet. And I said, go to bed. Take the other half tomorrow. You know, he thought that because he took the biggest half that he busted. The guy's terminally ill. And wonderful man. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. All right. Let's thank Mona Lisa and Mark for speaking. Thank you both. And we have one more reading, if I'm not mistaken, and that's Kimberly from San Diego. It's going to read, We Do Recover.
You won't be able to say that.
I know. Hey, my name's Kimberly, and I'm an addict. We do recover. When at the end of the road we find that we can no longer function as human beings, either with or without drugs, we all face the same dilemma. What is there left to do? There seems to be this alternative. Either go on as best we can to the bitter ends, jails, institutions, or death, or find a new way to live. In years gone by, very few addicts have ever had this last choice. Those who are addicted today are more fortunate. For the first time in man's entire history, a simple way has been proving itself in the life of many addicts. It is available to us all. This is a simple, spiritual, not religious program known as Narcotics Anonymous.